can't do. And we're talking in point G now, the marital covenant, and the passage we're again referring to, we're doing a passage from Genesis 2:24. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And so put your hands over the kids' ears for this one, because we're going to talk about sex, the one flesh relationship. Oh, a sudden hush came over all of the crowd. Does everyone have a handout? If not, it's a very untypical place because it seems like everywhere someone has a handout. Let's look again under this passage. They shall be one flesh at what God says in Genesis 1, verses 27 and 28. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And so marriage, as we said in the comment here, cannot be separated from God's creating people in two genders, either male or female. And the command in the first marriage, there was a commission that God had given to our first parents, Adam and Eve. And what was that twofold commission? The first thing was to be fruitful and multiply. What does this mean? Was heißt das? It means to have kids. Kinder. Have some kinder. That's the purpose for the making of a male and a female, is to make children. And he had already impressed this idea of one kind making the same kind of creatures or living creatures on day five and six of the creation, as we remember. And even with plants on day, what was that, three? So God gives life, and life is always giving more. God's gifts are never so isolated that they don't bear fruit and give more. And so the first commission to Adam and Eve is to have children. And then the second part is what? Replenish the earth and subdue it, which means you are the caretakers. The earth is abundant with life, and all of it is under your care. There were some kids in class this week who said, does God want us to have pets? Because they were waging an argument as to whether the household should have a dog or not. And under that, I said, yeah, God wants us to have animals, but maybe it's a little different than the argument that you're having at home. The animals are ours. Okay, so that's the huge commission that God gave to our first parents. First of all, to fill the earth with children, and then also to have dominion, to be lords and ladies of the church, of the world. And in the image of God, that when creation would want to see what God is like, they would look at the ones who had dominion, who were made in God's image. And there they would see God's holiness. Adam and Eve, having the knowledge of God, which the only creatures that would have the knowledge of God, would impart that knowledge to creation by ruling the world under that knowledge and with that knowledge. And so they would represent God. We did the fourth commandment in the opening today. As parents, represent God. When children disobey their parents, they are disobeying God. Not that their parents are God, but God stands above the parents and gives them their authority. And so that's the way that works. So moving on then to Genesis 38:9-10. I've just got a couple of Bible passages here as illustrative. How many of you have heard of the sin of Onan? Yeah. You have to be around for a while to have the sin of Onan. And it's sort of debated what the sin of Onan is. So let's take a look at that. Onan knew that the seed should not be his, and it came to pass when he went in unto his brother's wife that he spilled it on the ground, lest he should give seed to his brother. Now, I think we had mentioned this custom before under that passage where Jesus is asked about the seven brothers each being married to that oldest brother's wife. And so this is really sort of the seed of that custom, that in Israel, when the people had land, it was theirs forever. And so the oldest son would get a double portion of that inheritance, but if he had no sons in order to inherit that, then who would get it? And that's why it was commanded within this society that the brothers, when the brother dies, the next brother in line would raise up children through his wife. Now that sounds really weird to us, but that was the custom, so that he would have an heir. He would have someone that would inherit that eternal inheritance that God was giving them. And so Onan has an older brother that has died, and it's his duty to go and raise up kids for his brother. But when he has sex with his brother's wife, instead of giving her the seed, he spills the seed upon the ground. And what happens? And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, wherefore he slew him also. So what is the sin of Onan? Not putting the seed where it was supposed to go. I remember when I was a kid, this passage was used by the pastors and teachers that it was a sin of masturbation, which I suppose applies to the extent that, as Lisa said, the seed isn't going where it was intended to go in masturbation. But what is it that displeases God? Well, it's a misuse of sex. That sex is to produce children. Onan's duty, according to the customs of his day, was to do what? Produce children. And he didn't produce children. And spilled his seed upon the ground so that that couldn't happen. Does that say anything about birth control? It may have some impact. Moving on, 1 Corinthians, I could see everyone squirming. This is a very personal subject and one that's really controversial and one that's almost never talked about, and so it's an uncomfortable kind of thing. But that's why we're sort of raising the issues now, if there are some questions. Yes, Pastor Wolf.
I was at seminary, and Professor Rocky, in the Old Testament, he had a saying, he said, "You learn when you squirm."
Sometimes squirming means that there's some learning that's going to go on. Okay. Good. Does anyone have a problem with saying that the purpose of sex, the main purpose of sex, as God has designed it, is to produce children? I mean, we would have a big argument with that in culture today. I mean, you can't hold that and say that a homosexual marriage would be good. If the purpose of sex is to have children, you could never promote that. Because that's a waste. It's not just spilling the seed upon the ground. It's putting it where it really doesn't belong.
Pastor, I don't know how many people watch the program 19 Kids and Counting. But that, just like you said, that they have, that they believe too that they have the children, you know, and two of them, I guess, got married. And they're not shown it on TV yet, but somebody found it on the computer that both the one daughter's already pregnant.
Yeah, and is there a cult that sort of takes that principle that sex is for producing children and goes wild with it? Mormonism, right? Mormons believe that God had sex up in marriage with his wife, whatever her name is. She never gets billing. But they had spirit children up in heaven that are waiting to be born. So it's our duty to make these spirit children have a place for them to come to earth. And if you do that, you can someday be a god and go to your own planet and have spiritual sex and repopulate your own planet.
This is, I think, the Baptist or some type of Baptist or Methodist or Southern anyway.
Okay, so the purpose of sex, according to God's usage, is to have children. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 7, then. This is a passage that, if you've gone through premarital counseling with me, it is one that we've looked at. Now, concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. What does that mean, to avoid fornication? Let every man have his own wife, and let every wife have her own husband. How does that avoid fornication? What is fornication? Yeah, fornication is sex outside of marriage, and which commandment stands against fornication and adultery? The sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. What does this mean? We should fear and love God, that we may lead a chaste and decent life in word and deed, and each love and honor his spouse. So what he's saying here is that outside of marriage, having sexual relations is a sin. But sex was made for the marital relationship. And so within the relationship of marriage, sex is sanctioned. And in sanction, you hear the word sanctus, which means holy. Within marriage, it is sanctified by God, especially when Christians are engaged in that, in their faith, that God has given them one to another, and that this is the reason that he gave them to each other for the marriage covenant and union. So understand marriage as a curb to sin. It is an outlet for that very strong drive that God has put into us for sex. And the proper outlet for that, then, is marriage. Now, I think we've mentioned that before. Where does this drive in human nature come from for marriage and to have sex? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from God's command, be fruitful and multiply. Now, in our sin, we don't understand it that way. Sinful people misread that drive and say, I just want pleasure. I just want the good feelings that it's going to cause. But the drive behind that strong sexual drive in human beings is God's command to be fruitful and multiply. That's why your neighbor humps on your leg when you go over there. Your neighbor's dog humps on your leg. When you go over there. Hopefully your neighbor doesn't. Okay, so nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. So look at the little discussion questions on the side. The essence and uniqueness of the marriage relationship as God intended it is the marital covenant. And that means promises of faithfulness are made between the husband and wife. Faithfulness in what? Does it mean that the wife will never talk to another man? Or that the husband another woman? Well, legalists would say, yeah, he better not look at another woman. But that's not what it's saying. What it's talking about is faithfulness as far as the sexual relationship is concerned. Faithfulness that I will only have sex with my wife, and she has promised that she will only have sex with me, And if one of the marriage couples, one of the couple in marriage breaks that covenant, we've already said that that is a biblical reason for divorce. The breaking of that covenant. Unfaithfulness. So the uniqueness of the marital relationship is the one flesh relationship. And who's in charge of that relationship? Look in verse 3. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. Now, rendering and due sounds like a debt being paid, an obligation. What is the husband's obligation under that first part in the marriage covenant? If his wife has sexual appetite, who is supposed to fulfill it? He is. That's the wedding covenant. And likewise also the wife unto the husband. So we've talked about headship a little bit, but in this one flesh relationship, who's in charge? God's going to tell him? Now? Now? What? Who's in charge? Husband or wife? Yeah, husband and wife. Husband and wife. There's a mutual obligation that is due them. And if you ain't paying the bill, what are you doing to your partner? You're reneging on the arrangement. You're cheating them out of what is due them. Now, people come to me with a lot of things, and I wouldn't share with you specifically what they come to me for. But hardly ever anyone comes to me about the sexual relationship. But I know from experience, I know from being friends with other people that are married, that there are times when one marriage partner refuses the other marriage partner when they have sexual appetite. Barb and I, when we were in Vicarage in California, there was a number of couples that were involved in Lutheran Marriage Encounter. And so part of the Vicarage assignment was to go to Lutheran Marriage Encounter. And it was astounding to me when this topic came up, where they said, well, you just have to be understanding. And I'm going, that's not exactly what St. Paul was saying here about that. But as I said, having friends having confidences, I know that there are marriages that have dissolved over this issue. And it's important for us to understand that when one partner doesn't follow through on that, it's a great frustration. And is it more than a frustration? It's displeasing to God. That's why He made marriage. Any comments? The wife, verse 4, the wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife, verse 5, defraud ye not one the other. What's fraud? That's making a contract and breaking it. It's not rendering your part of the agreement. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. So sex is important in the marriage relationship. That's what we've been saying. But what is St. Paul saying here? There's something more important. Your relationship with God. Your sexual appetites should not be the number one priority in your life, even though that you're married, because the number one priority in your Christian life is God. And so he's saying, with mutual consent, which means talking to each other and saying, we're going to defer having sex for this reason, and it might not be because God told me not to, because that would be enthusiasm and would be really bad. But if it's in light of the faith, and if it's in light of the relationship with God, then by mutual consent, the husband and wife can say, we're not defrauding each other, but we are agreeing not to have sex for this time and for this reason. And that's what partners do. Partners don't rule in an autocratic way, but partners in one flesh make agreements with each other. So defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan you not tempt for your incontinency. Which means that in the marriage, if one is deprived, the other, with a great deal of appetite that isn't being filled, may turn to someone outside the marriage. Luther used to, in his premarital counseling, would say, if the matron won't, the maid might. And so, as marriage is a curb to sin, it is also then an opportunity to promote sin if this relationship is not honored. But I speak this by permission and not by command, for I would that all men were even as myself. Now some point to that and say, St. Paul was a homosexual. You know who says that? The homosexuals. But what is... what is the gift that St. Paul is talking about here? Yeah, he had a special gift of celibacy, which means he had a gift from God that he did not have those appetites that would drive him like most of the rest of us are driven, and that he could look upon a woman and see her as a sister and not think about her as a possible wife or think about her in that way. And that would be a wonderful gift. I'm sure the Roman Catholic Church would love it if God would give that gift to all of its priests. Because that's what they assume, that becoming a priest, they must be given that attribute from God. And history and evidence brings us to the conclusion that it just doesn't work that way. Yes. It means to give benefit to give her the benefit that she's asking for. Kindness. Benevolence is a beautiful term because it connotes gentleness and seeing a need and fulfilling that need and looking at that person as one that I serve. So give benevolence to that person. Someone who needs something and I'm giving benevolence. Okay? But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and one after another. So, is Paul commanding them to be married or permitting it? Permitting it. He's not commanding that they get married, but he is permitting it. But he's giving us godly guidance as to what it's for and how it ought to be carried out. And what is Paul's gift he wished others possessed? We've already talked about that, the gift of celibacy. Now, you know, the thing that comes up to us today is, what is the role of reason and family planning? You know, we've got all kinds of birth control methods and that sort of thing. And is there any guidance that we might glean from the Bible passages that we've looked at that would help us? If our reason says, I don't want to have a lot of children, that sort of in that reason might be pushing up against God's command to be fruitful and multiply. And yet, in reason, there may be reasons that you want to family plan in that way. And is reason in that case always going to be against God in his desire for us to be fruitful or multiply? Or do you think there can ever be sort of a compromise between reason, in other words, using our reason and our choices and our thoughts, and using that reason in a way that also respects God's command to be fruitful and to multiply? And that's sort of the predicament, I think, that we're in a lot of the choices that we make in life. Our reason tells us one thing, and then that reason sort of pushes against sometimes the commandments of God. And yet our reason, we can't exactly put away our reasons a lot of times, because those reasons are real and they stand in our face. And so it's really a conundrum sometimes. Lisa, you had your hand up. Yeah, you know, what you're saying there, Lisa, rings a bell, because, you know, when our forefathers in the Lutheran Church came over in the mid-19th century, one of the things they talked about is if we had a big family in Germany, we'd have no way of taking care of them. We'd have all kinds of kids that would starve, but they loved coming to America because if they worked hard, a big family and many kids would become a benefit because they'd have these big farm stands that they couldn't have in Germany. And having sons to work them was a great benefit. And all of a sudden, there was no conflict between reason and wanting to feed my kids and having a big family. This is one of the joys and the blessings that our fathers talked about in coming to America. Yes? Well, it is. I guess I'm leading you to, well, how much time do we have? What is it? We're done?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you my bottom line on this. And I'm standing here between reason and the command of God. And as I do in many cases, I'm deferring to the Roman Catholic Church. I think the Roman Catholic Church has the right view and doctrine if Francis allows it to stand. What is the Roman Catholic way that they do that? Well, they use reason, and they say there are times when the woman is most fertile and when she's least fertile, and I'm going to use my reason and not have sex during the times when they are most fertile. Now, that doesn't interrupt the one-flesh relationship. Barriers does that. A barrier method comes between the male and female in the one-flesh. Chemicals, again, are something that come between the man and woman in one flesh. But we have a choice of when we have sex. And we can, by mutual assent or consent, abstain any time that we want under God's rule. And so the Catholic method is, they call it the rhythm method, of not having sex when the woman is most fertile. And that way you still give God the choice. It's still possible to conceive at other times. It happens. But you've also used your reason to tell God your choice, and he can overrule you. So I like the Roman Catholic teaching on that with that method of birth control. And I get the final word on it because our time is up.
But,
yeah, we can talk about it. Sure. Yeah, let's bring it up next time.
Sure.